From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Money Plus Politics will look at a new project that aims to change the equation. Tomorrow is Super Tuesday. Most eyes are on Texas and Florida, the big delegate states. We'll look at poverty that persists in two of the other states, Tennessee and Mississippi.
Quite apart from traditional poor that we've always had in Mississippi, there is now what I call the new poor, the lower middle class poor, people who have worked, have had working class jobs, but are redundant in the labor force. And no one is talking about how we make this kind of an economy a place that respects the rights and the dignity of those people. And I think candidates ought to speak to that directly and profoundly.
A look at the movement to bring back the teaching of creationism in the public schools. And former Speaker of the House Tom Foley is concerned about public cynicism, but says his generous congressional pension is besides the point. That and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. There are indications Steve Forbes may be preparing to get out of the Republican presidential race. One of his senior aides says Forbes might drop out in 2 or 3 weeks if Bob Dole agrees to push for tax reform. The aide says Forbes is looking for some sort of recognition of his role in the nomination battle. Publicly, however, Forbes dismisses the idea of his leaving the race. And on the eve of this critical Super Tuesday primaries, Republican presidential candidate Pat Buchanan is planning a campaign swing through Oklahoma. Buchanan acknowledges the odds are against him in winning the GOP nomination, but he still calls his campaign the miracle of 1996. Buchanan told a Texas rally last night he doesn't know what's going to happen to him, but says he'll fight to make sure the Republican Party remains opposed to abortion. Rejecting suggestions that his campaign might be damaging the party, Buchanan says he's been a good Republican and only wants to bring supporters of Ross Perot back into the GOP. And a day before 7 states vote in the Super Tuesday primaries, Bob Dole is campaigning in the 2 biggest, Texas and Florida. Dole said at a rally yesterday in Melbourne, Florida, if one candidate should win all 7 states, I think this thing is virtually over. The Senate Majority Leader has been stressing his 30 years' experience in Washington. He also says he's no longer paying attention to his Republican rivals, but to defeating President Clinton in November. 362 Republican delegates are at stake tomorrow, just under 2/3 of them in Texas and Florida. Dole has 2 more campaign stops planned for today in Fort Lauderdale and San Antonio before heading home to Washington. Well, if it's Monday, it's money here on Democracy Now! And today in our Money Talks segment, we look at an attempt to have citizens talk to the ever-increasing role of money in politics. Joining us to talk about this issue is Becky Kane. She is chair of the League of Women Voters, and she is part of a project that is bringing groups together around the country in 6 different states to look at this issue and to come up with solutions. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Becky Kane.
Well, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Why don't you tell us what the League of Women Voters is doing?
Well, we're working with the Harwood Group, which is another organization that's interested in getting people together and talking about issues, to bring, as you mentioned, in 6 different sites across the country, individuals together to talk about money and politics and how people might change that equation. And what we've seen is that citizens do care and have concerns about money and politics. They are less united or even hopeful that that can be changed, and it's our hope that with the project we'll be able to bring people together to talk among themselves, to talk with elected officials, to see how they might indeed be able to make some change and to change that equation.
What states are you doing this in, and how are you choosing the people in each state?
Well, we're doing it in, I guess we kick off in Greeley, Colorado, then go to Chicago, Illinois, Newton, Massachusetts, Tallahassee, Florida, Seattle, Washington, and Los Angeles, California. And we're doing sort of a random sample of the community. We will have some phone numbers picked at random, And our recruiters, our volunteers, will call these folks and talk to them and try to get some sense of age, background, and so forth, and so that they really will reflect the communities that they live in. We don't want it, we want it to be very much representative of the community.
Mm-hmm. And then what will happen? How long will these people gather for? How will they be informed about money and politics?
Well, we have put together an advisory committee which has helped us choose what kinds of information. And it's people that have been interested in campaign finance reform as well as academics, and to make sure that we don't in any way bias the information. They will actually meet in their groups to talk about these things five different times, actually. The first time they meet, they'll just sort of try to understand and define the problem. And we have given them and will give them some just basic information about money in politics, about what the terminology means, about how the system works now. And we've run it through our advisory committee to make sure that we aren't going to in any way bias the slant. I mean, we really just want to give them the information that they need. So in the first assembly, they just sort of talk about what this thing is and define the problem and get an understanding of how the system works. In the second assembly, the second time they meet, then they will come back and try to wrestle with some options for action. We're not going to give them what the different alternatives. We're going to let them talk about what they think might be possible alternatives. Then the third time they meet, they'll come together with office holders. So much of the discussion around campaign finance reform has been some concern about office holders' ability to manipulate the system and what the trade-offs may or may not be. So in the third assembly, they will actually be able to talk with office holders and get everybody's point of view together and allow the office holders to really hear what the citizens think. Then in the fourth assembly, they'll really start to clarify the issues and some of the choices. They will have put the options out there. They will have talked to elected officials. And they'll really start beginning to mold their opinion. And then in the fifth one, they will really make some choices and decide how they really feel about the issue so that we can compile a report at the end of all of this process in all of these cities to really clarify the public's concern and options and how they feel about the system and about how money drives the system.
Will you be bringing in people, for example, that were defeated, people who ran for public office? Will you be bringing in third-party representatives to talk about how the system focuses on just two parties?
Well, I frankly don't know the answer to that one. I don't think that we're going to be focusing at all. We're trying not to focus specifically on any type of problem ourselves. What we've been trying to do is let the public define those issues. We will be bringing in experts from time to time, but I honestly don't know who we have on the agenda in some of these places to talk to them, so I'd hate to tell you.
Well, let me put the question to Richard Harwood,
sure.
Who is joining us from the Harwood Group, which is a consulting group that is joining the League of Women Voters in running these different groups in the six different states, and we welcome you to Democracy Now!
It's good to be with you.
This question of when you bring in the experts to talk about money and then you bring in the public officials to give their views on how money enters into the public campaigns, will you also bring in representatives of third parties and people who've been defeated in elections who can talk about the problem and the obstacles that money poses and how it reinforces a two-party system?
Well, I think that's a possibility. I think the most important thing in how we go about this process is to make sure that different voices get heard by citizens, whether they're in person or over a video or through written materials. We believe it's important that they get the full spectrum, the whole story about what they need to think about.
The reason I asked the question and the reason I interested in these kind of groups that form around the country is I watched carefully the National Issues Convention that ran on PBS.
Right.
And I think there were a lot of problems with that convention. And one of the problems was that they identify the people before the big TV event where people got to ask questions. They had planned who it would be that asked the question. Well, they said this was a very representative group, and you saw people of all colors in the audience. It turned out that at least the day I watched, when this large group of Americans who were pulled from all over the country and had gone through days of of education, that when they were brought together and their, quote, leaders asked questions, they had eight people asking questions of Vice President Dole on Democrat night, and all eight of them were white, six of them were men, and overall they asked extremely conservative questions except for one of the women in the group. How is this decided, and will yours be any different?
I think ours will be different in two fundamental ways. One is we're going to make sure that the folks who participate or who are participating now in these citizen assemblies represent a cross-section of America. If we don't do that, if we fail to do that, I would say that the project has come up well short of its goals. The second thing is when we, in the third citizen assembly, when we bring citizens together with elected officials, perhaps other people, a third-party person who has lost, or even one of the main two-party persons who have lost. Those conversations, those assemblies will be a conversation. They won't be, as happened at the National Issues Convention, sort of the typical town hall meeting where one person stands up at a microphone, nails a public official with a question, and then it's just the public official essentially holding a press conference. What we want to create is a fundamentally different approach, which is a conversation among all the participants and all the officials, leaders, candidates who are sitting around the table with them. That's going to take creating a different ground rules for the ways in which that conversation unfolds.
Let me ask you something. You do have some preconceived ideas of how people, of what people think of money in politics. I was looking through your America's Struggle Within, Citizens Talk About the State of the Union, put out by the Harwood Group, and you have an idea of what people feel about money in politics. Is there a sentiment that campaigns shouldn't be publicly funded? If a candidate wants to run, why should we pay for it?
Well, I think we have a first cut at what the public thinks, and I think that's one of the things that will make this project different from other projects that have come before it. I think we know, for instance, that a lot of people think that moneyed interests are more important in candidates and politicians' eyes than is the common interest. I think we know that people believe that politicians increasingly use their money to talk down other candidates as opposed to stating what they believe. We think increasingly that citizens believe that when they look at candidates and public officials, they don't see themselves. They say that these people do not look like me, do they not feel like me. Anyone who raises the amount of money that they have to raise is living an entirely different life than I live. That's what we know. What we don't know, and what we hope to find out through this work, is what does that mean for where people want to move the political system? And here I think there are lots of internal or inherent conflicts in the debate. For instance, as you talk about public financing, for instance, let's say full public financing. On the one hand, there are those people who say that'll level the playing field, it'll make it fairer, and perhaps more competitive. You have other people who say that runs counter to competition. What we need actually is more money in the process so that people, for instance, who are a minority candidate, people who are just first starting out, can raise more money to level the playing field. And so you have a conflict in values between how we think about fairness, how we think about competition, how we think about a lot of other political values. And I think fundamentally when you strip aside or strip away all the jargon about campaign finance reform, what you have is a full and needed debate about our political values in a day and age of rapid change and fundamental change.
We're talking with Richard Harwood. He's head of the Harwood Group, which is joining with the League of Women Voters to conduct these six, and you are careful not to say focus groups, but
right,
six groups around the country to look at the issue of money in politics. Becky Kane, let me ask you how people can get involved. Is this being done randomly so people can't say to you in Colorado, for example, the first place you're going to go, I would like to be a part of this group? And how many people are in each state?
That's correct. It is a random sample, and because we do, as Rich mentioned, want to be very careful that we do reflect the communities and where they live and the American population. So it isn't something you can volunteer for. It is something that we hope to be able to select the random sample. And the other question was how many are going to be in the group?
Yes.
I honestly don't know. Rich, how many?
24. 24 in each group. And let me just pick up where Becky left off. The second phase of this project will be where we roll out sort of a streamlined version of these conversations so that people across America, volunteers, as you suggest, can plug into this process. And I think that's an important element of this work as it rolls out into the future.
How can they do it?
We're going to be a couple different ways. One is the League of Women Voters will be spearheading sort of the distribution of these materials across the country. In addition, we're going to identify five sort of leading organizations that people believe in and which have credibility who will spread these materials out as well. But Becky, is it fair to say that they could call the League of Women Voters to get the materials?
Oh, absolutely. This is, as you mentioned, this is phase one, and we're kicking it off now, and Rich is absolutely correct. We will have phase two so that we can broaden, see how the system works, see how people have been involved in this phase, and then take it all across the country. And absolutely, they can call their League of Women Voters, ask if they can be a part of it, get the materials, no doubt about it.
And you can call your League of Women Voters anywhere around the country. In Washington, the number is 202-429-1965. That's 202-429-1965. Now, let me ask you something, Becky Kane. I see that this whole project is sponsored by the Pew Center for Civic Journalism. Now, the Pew Center and the Pew Charitable Organization, Philadelphia, is a very establishment group, as is the League of Women Voters. There may be some skepticism that people have that this is going to very much reinforce the status quo. For example, I know that the League of Women Voters has been involved with a number of controversies around who gets to debate in presidential debates, congressional debates, and that it very much focuses on the two-party system and third-party candidates feel very left out. What is your response to that?
Well, first of all, we do have another partner, and that's the Joyce Foundation. We are, in, as you mentioned, a very established organization, and over the years have really gotten the trust of the American public. While we may indeed have not always been able to accommodate everyone in the presidential debates, we have always used a system that has stood the test of time and the courts to make sure that we have had an opportunity to bring you as many candidates as possible, given the format and the restrictions that we've had to live with over airtime. I think the general public does understand that the League's mission is to get people involved in the process, regardless of how they may feel or how they may care about a particular issue. We want people involved in the process. We want them talking about public policy, regardless of how they cast a ballot or regardless of what they say to their members of Congress or their city officials when they do participate. Our goal is to get you involved in the process. And frankly, not only does this kind of a project deal with an issue of concern, an issue that keeps people, frankly, out of the process because there's so much emphasis on money from time to time, but this project actually has also a component that does allow people to come together and, as Rich mentioned, exercise their concerns, talk about what's on their mind. We won't preset any agenda. We won't in any way try to impose anyone's views except the citizens involved in the process. And I think that the citizens will be able and should be able to trust the League. As Rich mentioned, if we in any way don't live up to the integrity that we've built into the process, then we, the League, will think that we have failed. And we don't want to do that to ourselves, to our project, or to the American people.
Rich Harwood, we just have 30 seconds, but I wanted to ask you about David Broder's attack on Chuck Lewis of the Center for Public Integrity. David Broder, The Washington Post, saying that his focus on money makes people cynical. Do you think you'll be making people cynical, or are they already?
I think they're frustrated. I think they're exasperated by where the country is, and they believe now that we lack the capacity and the sense of public responsibility to solve many of these problems. I think fundamentally what we will do differently than perhaps Chuck Lewis did, is we're going to open up this debate not about campaign finance reform, but about people's frustrations with politics and the relationship of money to those frustrations and what their aspirations are for America's political system. As we do that, I think this debate will enlarge beyond sort of the typical campaign finance reform debate and begin to let people in to thinking about how we reframe and rethink what it means to have a political process.
Well, Richard Harwood of the Harwood Group, Becky Kane, chair of the League of Women Voters, thank you very much for joining us. Up next, we go down south. Super Tuesday is tomorrow. We're going to look at two states involved, Mississippi and Tennessee, after this. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Democracy Now! Is Pacifica's national daily grassroots election show. Coming up in just a little while, we're going to be hearing from Larry Bensky out in California, talking to former Speaker of the House, Tom Foley, talking about, for example, his congressional pension and other issues, what he sees today in the 104th Congress. But before we do that, we're going down south. Tomorrow is Super Tuesday. Dole says this is key. If he wins all the states tomorrow, then his victory is absolutely assured. Pat Buchanan says he's going to continue. There's word that Forbes may be dropping out. We're talking about 362 Republican delegates at stake tomorrow, and almost two-thirds of them are in Texas and Florida. We're not going to focus on those states today. We're going to be talking about them tomorrow. Larry Bensky is currently in Texas, and we'll be joining with him and some activists. We've chosen to look at two other states. We're going to be looking at poverty and the issue of public education and creationism in Tennessee and Mississippi. We'll be joined by two guests, a professor from Jackson State in Mississippi, and we'll also be joined by the head of the Highlander Center, a longtime activist training center in Tennessee. But before we do that, we thought we would bring you a little of this.
Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest, and everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn! Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest, and everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn! Can't you see it? Can't you feel it? It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest, and everybody knows about Mississippi. Goddamn!
It's hard for me to think of Mississippi and Tennessee without thinking of Nina Simone. Thank you for that, Nina. Right now, we go down to Mississippi and Tennessee. We're joined by Professor Mary Coleman, who is a professor of political science at Jackson State University in Mississippi. And we're joined by Jim Sessions, who is head of the Highlander Center in Tennessee. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Thanks.
You know, I don't think many people realize, Jim Sessions, that Rosa Parks actually trained at the Highlander Center in Tennessee. Many people think of her as an independent, tired woman who just decided she wasn't going to sit in the back of the bus. But in fact, she was a trained activist.
Mrs. Parks was a seamstress in Montgomery and the secretary of the NAACP chapter in Montgomery, and was an active participant in workshops about desegregation in the public schools and the future of integration in the South. So it was no accident she sat down. She knew what she was doing.
Now, it sounds like you're continuing the kind of training that Rosa Parks was involved in your democracy schools. Can you tell us about them?
Well, just like just like those days in workshops that Rosa Parks and Septima Clark and Dr. King and John Lewis and Andy Young and others participated in. Our focus is on communities and grassroots actions, like the Montgomery bus boycott was a homegrown local activity. And so our attention continues to be on community organizations and community-based problem-solving by local folks themselves. And so our devotion is still the same. It just happens in different ways these days.
Mm-hmm. As I said, we're also joined by Dr. Mary Coleman of Jackson State, who has an extremely interesting history. She's been involved with chronicling the struggle for political and social freedom in Mississippi, is writing a book called Exits about the opportunities for African Americans in Mississippi to exit out of poverty, studying three generations in Indianola, Mississippi. Now, is this right, Mary Coleman, where the original seminal work, Caste and Class in a Southern Town, was based?
That's exactly right. Dollard's work in the 30s. And Horton's Powder Maker also studied the same town later on, toward the end of the 1930s.
And
her book was After Freedom.
What are you finding today in Mississippi in terms of African Americans and their standard of living?
Well, particularly in the Mississippi Delta, we're finding double-digit unemployment rates. We're finding increasingly, as we are across the United States, that people who are marginally skilled, marginally educated, simply don't have a place in the workforce, as they did, say, in the 1970s throughout the U.S. But in particular, the communities that have been the hardest hit are the ones that do not have an agricultural base anymore that depends on people working. There has been some mechanization of work, and thus the ability of people who are just marginally skilled to find a job that paid a decent wage, that possibility is not great anymore in the Delta or elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Now, you, in addition to looking at Mississippi itself and to looking at people in Mississippi, have been going around the world looking at first-time voters in places as far-flung as Baku, in places like South Africa. You observe the elections there, in Zimbabwe as well. And then in April, you're headed off to where?
Bucharest. Romania.
Now, what are the connections you make when you look at elections and electoral politics in other places, and you look at elections in this country from your vantage point in Mississippi?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question, because it's not always obvious to people when I speak with them. When I was in Baku, I was interested, obviously, in observing the parliamentary elections for the United States. But I also had an opportunity to speak at four private universities there to students who, for the first time in their lives, will shortly be casting ballots. I was interested in their understanding about what democracy is and what it requires from its citizens. And so for me, that was the challenge, to talk to them in a vocabulary that utilizes words like accountability, citizenship, liberties, the balance between the personal rights of individuals and group rights and social responsibilities. Those are the same kinds of issues that we have been dealing with in Mississippi for a very, very long time, trying to get citizens to understand what they must do in order to keep their government accountable, and trying to get the state and the government to understand its varying responsibilities to citizens and to itself. And more increasingly in America, there is a corporate citizen that we also must get that citizen in line, so that together all of these publics can address this question of poverty and why it is in America and elsewhere that young people getting out of high school and college don't have any real prospects for work, except in some European countries. We don't have an easy high school to job transition in America, and we sorely need that. Now, in the newly developing democracies, say in Azerbaijan, there simply are not jobs for people to do, especially people who do not have skills. And so this country is in its infancy, both in terms of market economics and in terms of democracy. And these twin pillars sometimes lead to competing ends. But it's important, I think, that citizens everywhere know that they can and must make government and corporate America accountable, even as they become more fully mobilize and become more accountable to their own societies and their own communities.
When you teach people about liberties and accountability abroad, I mean, in this country, there is a great racial divide. What do you do in a country that in many ways is seen as highly developed, that has as many ways as called a democracy, and yet for many people, they may have less access to that than people who have never voted at all in other countries?
Yeah, that's the number one question I was asked, especially in Baku. I think the very fact that I am a Black American made the students want to understand why is it that I could stand there and talk to them about democracy, knowing full well that its promise has been rarely realized for many Black Americans, especially in southern places. But I think the connection is this. Even as each generation struggles to make the state and to make itself more accountable, we encounter new problems. In America, and I think this is one of the problems that the Republican candidates are having a hard time handling, and I think it's going to be an issue that President Clinton will need to answer more directly than he has. How is it that America has advancing technology, that advancing technology is creating jobs, while just as rapidly it is making other people obsolete? And people in my neck of the woods have been obsolete for a very long time. So now we're making people who have been in the workforce obsolete. Through no fault of their own, they find themselves with pink slips, and they're understandably angry and anxious. So what we do as a nation to address that problem, it seems to me, is at the core of the discourse that ought to be going on in America, but also throughout the Western world.
And what about people who, in fact, have never had access to jobs in this country?
Well, in this country, that segment that has had the hardest time with jobs has been Black males, especially those males between 18 to 32 years old. Their life chances have always been somewhat circumspect and limited. That hasn't changed. It's gotten worse. In the Mississippi Delta, where I've been doing my work in Sunflower County, the unemployment rates for Black men in that age cohort is sometimes up to 50%. There simply are not jobs there for them to do. You might ask, why then don't they move elsewhere to places where jobs are more plentiful? The difficulty is that throughout rural America, we are finding that there simply are not job prospects that make good sense in terms of the wage that is offered and in terms of the time away from family that men and often women must spend. So the prospects for that segment has gotten worse.
We're talking to Professor Mary Coleman. She is professor of political science at Jackson State University in Jackson, Mississippi. And we're going to come back to you, but we're going to change the subject for a second. Go back to Jim Sessions, head of the Highlander Center in Tennessee. And again, Tennessee and Mississippi, two of the states where primaries are taking place tomorrow. Yesterday on the front page of the New York Times, headline, Creationism Fight Returns to Nation's Classrooms. And it says, 70 years after John Scopes was convicted of teaching evolution in Dayton, Tennessee, the state legislature is considering permitting school boards to dismiss teachers who present evolution as fact rather than a theory of human origin. Jim Sessions, can you shed some light on this movement to return to creationism teachings in the public school?
Well, I think in this state it's somewhat of a marginal issue, and it's interesting that it comes up right before this primary and right before these general elections in the fall. A lot of times in Tennessee, social issues have been used, and the more outrageous, really, the more the press pays attention to them, to distract people from more basic problems that Dr. Coleman was talking about, mainly the vulnerability and insecurity of people in terms of the job market. So people get distracted off. We have another bill up about making it law for the Ten Commandments to be posted in every family, home and school and public place and so forth. But these come around. They come around often. They come around mainly as social distractions for more basic issues that people face.
Can you tell us what is going on in Tennessee today, and what do you see as the key issues?
Well, I think it reflects what we just heard from African-American Mississippi. This is a predominantly white a part of Tennessee, the Southern Mountains, and traditionally a Republican, and goes way back. And Republicans are probably more comfortable with Robert Dole because they fear change of almost any sort, right or left. And so I think people, traditional Republicans, are going to be voting tomorrow pretty much conventionally. But someone who's making a big play to lots of those people and playing on job security and vulnerability, of course, is Pat Buchanan. And he's speaking to the kinds of insecurities and fears of the future and scapegoating other people for people's situations that is attracting attention from folks who are frightened. And not to overlook the hypocrisy and the bigotry and the racism, the homophobia of Pat Buchanan, he still is speaking to the fear and insecurity and vulnerability of factory workers who are losing jobs, of textile and clothing workers, of mining, electronic loss to the maquiladoras, and so forth. So I think it's really important to watch what that kind of vote does. Tennesseans tomorrow are not going to get the vote for Lamar Alexander like some Republicans would like to have. And where they were going to cast those votes might be really interesting.
Jim Sessions, head of the Highlander Center, traditionally activist center going on for decades in Tennessee. Let's return to Mary Coleman at Jackson State. Have the candidates come through Mississippi?
Buchanan was here, I believe he was here by way of telephone yesterday when some 30 supporters gathered to listen to his telephone message. He was not here in person. Elizabeth Dole has been here. She was here, I think, last week. Dole has not been here thus far. So we've not gotten a lot of attention from the Republican candidates, no.
Pat Buchanan was almost a stealth candidate in East Tennessee. He slipped in pretty without a lot of notice and showed up at some Christian Academy to make a talk, and there was news coverage of that speech, but there was not a lot of play before he got here. He was in and out of town before anyone knew it.
Mm-hmm. Professor Coleman, let me ask you that question about the key issues in Mississippi today. And would you say that they're different for whites and for blacks?
Well, I think the key issues are the same for poor blacks and whites. I am not saying that they understand that they're the same, but they are the same. The quality of public education is a big question in Mississippi. The resegregation of public schools is certainly important in Mississippi. As you know, poor whites are not able to go to most of the private parochial schools, and therefore the education received by them is received in public schools or at home, so that there has to be some way in Mississippi to get public schools up to the quality that they need to be so that poor children can access better opportunities when they've received their first 12 years of education. Also in Mississippi these days, the Democratic Party is facing, continues to face, I think, an issue of isolationism. That is, the most dependable Democrats in Mississippi are blacks. And for the most part, since the mid-1960s in this state, we've seen more and more whites leave the Democratic Party, not necessarily going always to the Republican Party, some just staying as independents, but that very tenuous coalition of blacks and whites that we were able to get during the early 1980s in Mississippi has all but dissipated. So I think a part of the progress that we'll have to make in Mississippi will mean the revitalization of the Democratic Party. I also think on the Republican side that the issues that tend to unite the Republicans in Mississippi are all negative issues. I remember discussing with some of the students in Baku whether or not they thought their freedoms were negative freedoms or positive freedoms. And when we look around the country at constitutions and Bill of Rights, we often see a bunch of negative freedoms. But in any case, I'm reminded in Mississippi that among the Republicans, it seems to me that what unites them is this negative notion of what they have to be against rather than what they are for. They are against quotas, they are against set-asides, they are against not having an opportunity to do school prayer. They are against a number of things, but what are they for? I think it is harder for people to forge a positive unity, especially when that group of people wants to be so reactionary, so distant, wants to separate itself from one or another group of people
within
the same
community. Professor Coleman, we're going to have to end on that note. I want to thank you very much for joining us from Jackson State, and also thank Jim Sessions for joining us from Tennessee. In a future discussion, we have to talk about the church burning that has just taken place in Knoxville, Tennessee. That is for a future show. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, back next with Tom Foley. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the daily election year political talk show from Pacifica Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. When Democratic Representative Tom Foley lost his bid for re-election in 1994, it was the first time in 102 years that a sitting Speaker of the House was defeated. Although Foley is no longer a member of Congress, he's still intimately involved in national politics as a member of a Washington, D.C. law and lobbying firm. Last week, Foley was in California, where Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky caught up with him to get his perspectives on the house that Newt built and the presidential race.
Speaker Foley, this is the first time in 32 years you're not running for office, 1996. What's that doing to you?
Well, actually, it's kind of fun not to run for office. I was very grateful to my constituents for giving me a chance to represent them in Congress for 30 years. But every election for the past 15 times, a national election, I've been engaged in my own reelection, so it concentrates your attention, as they say. Now there's an opportunity to kind of sit back and look at the election, watch it with the interest of a detached private citizen.
Had you not been defeated, you would have been minority leader in the House, and you would have been minority leader, as Mr. Gephardt is, at the time of the Gingrich ascendancy. Do you follow Congress closely now? You're still in Washington, in a Washington law firm. Are you a C-SPAN junkie, watching it all the time, or have you unplugged from it?
Well, I've unplugged from it in the sense that I don't watch it sort of through the C-SPAN every day. I'm doing other things. But I am interested in what's going on there. I don't go up to the Hill very often, hardly at all. I don't think former speakers ought to hang around. But I don't think I'll ever lose an interest in the Congress or in public affairs. And when you spent 30 years in the House, you can't help but be interested in what's going on.
Well, as you do observe, as much as you do observe in Washington what's gone on in the Hill, there's a definite change of tone from the years that you were there. People are yelling at each other. All kinds of inflammatory speeches are being given during special orders. This is the kind of thing you showed a great distaste for when you were Speaker. Where is it coming from now?
Well, I think there's been a tendency, as you say, to become more confrontational in the House, to be, frankly, lack of civility, I think, is showing up. That's a concern to members themselves. Inflammatory speeches, tough relations between the parties, a lack of sort of acquaintance and friendship across party lines that used to exist there. I think part of it is a result of the fact that the issues have gotten pretty heated, and I think, frankly, the change in responsibility, with the first time the Republicans have been in charge in 40 years, caused the changeover and to bruise some feelings. And the Democrats aren't very comfortable in being the minority. They haven't been the minority before. And I don't think the Republicans have been as skilled as they might be in being the majority. Whether that'll improve or not, we'll see. I hope it does, because I think if you have too much tension and conflict and confrontation, then you don't really see the institution function as well. And the end product isn't as good, frankly.
You could have seen this coming, though. You saw Newt Gingrich and his band of seven Republicans quickly grow in power and in acerbity. As Speaker, was there anything that you could have done, do you think, in retrospect, to stop them and this rising Republican tide?
Well, I think there are two questions there. One, whether we could have done something to, you know, make the institution function in a more conciliatory way. I tried to do that after Speaker Wright resigned. I tried to calm down the tensions on the House floor and between the members, and to some extent I think I succeeded. But there was a residue of bitterness and anger over the right to resignation on the Democratic side with many members. There was a growing impatience on the Republican side to take responsibility for the House and win elections. And so it's I think, sort of developed from that period. As far as avoiding the election loss, looking back on the period between 1993 and 1994 and the election of 94, I think I would, if I had to do over again, urge the president to move more quickly on health care, accept maybe a less far-reaching bill, move on to other issues. I think we got bogged down with health care. It created an eventual I think reaction of public anger that we hadn't finished anything so significant. There were a lot of other things that, you looking back on it, you can think you should have done better and quicker.
What about campaign finance? Let's take one of those. That's one of the ones that the Democratic Party is constantly criticized about. You had a chance, you had majorities, you had a president in the White House who could have signed something. It didn't get done, and now we have complete runaway abuse in many people's eyes of soft money, hard money, personal money, money completely driving the system.
Well, campaign finance reform is tough legislation to pass, first of all, because it's something that's very important in elections, and members are all experts on it. This isn't something casual, and it's something they think they know something about. There are some differences between the parties, too, on how they view campaign reform. So the Republicans told us in 1993, there's no way we're going to give you any votes. You're not going to get any votes from us. You've got to pass this bill among your own Democratic members. On our own side, there were differences of opinion about, with women members, for example, felt very strongly about Emily's List, a special program in which work was done to help women candidates. PACs, although they're widely criticized, are helpful to candidates who can't raise all of their money in their own districts. Women and minority members, and especially, need some help. So we finally, at the end of 1994, had gotten a bill passed in the House, passed in the Senate, and an agreed conclusion between the two of them, and the Republican Senate members filibustered the appointment of the conference that was going to resolve those differences. The first time in 200 years and more that a conference was ever filibustered. So I must say that what they did was hold and hit, and by preventing through technical interruption of the process, the final product being achieved, we weren't able to pass it. And we got the blame, not the Republicans. That was an interesting conclusion.
Nevertheless, I think you have to agree that the campaign finance system is out of control. You had to raise yourself more than $2 million in your last race for Congress in the state of Washington, which is enough in other states to win a Senate seat or a governorship. Now we see another election cycle where we're seeing the spectacle of private money, Steve Forbes here in California, Michael Huffington, of course, Ross Perot. So between public and private financing, a lot of people are saying, one of the reasons I'm turned off to this political system is the finance of campaigns is out of control.
Well, the problem with the unlimited funding by candidates who have money is the Supreme Court decision, Butler versus Vallejo some years ago, which said that you can't restrict an individual candidate from spending his or her own money, though that's a problem. We'd have to change the Constitution to do much about that. I think it was wrongly decided, but I think we're stuck with a decision unless the Supreme Court changes its mind. On the question of reforming the system, frankly, I think the best way to reform the system would be to have a significant part of public, partial public financing in Congress as we do for the presidential election. But it's widely unpopular. And the problem in part is the fact that this is a system that would help challengers, frankly, more than it would help incumbents. And incumbents know that. Even so, and many incumbents would be willing to support partial public financing as a reform, but they would expect almost inevitably that they'd get some credit for having taken an action against their own interest in order to reform the system. Instead, the average and immediate reaction of most people is, well, you're trying to finance your own campaigns. You're trying to get public money from yourself. So that's very hard to pass.
One of the...
I don't mean to sound totally pessimistic about it. We need to do it, and I'm disappointed that the Speaker and the President, who shook hands about doing campaign reform in January, haven't... Well, I think I have to blame this on the Congress because they haven't sent the President any legislation. They haven't moved on it.
They were supposed to appoint a joint commission, which never got appointed. One of the things that people also criticize is Congress's privileges. And one of the privileges that's been criticized, and I've seen you criticized for this as a matter of fact, is congressional pensions. People serve, as you did for 30 years, and you get, I don't know, $125,000, $130,000 a year pension. Plus, you're able, as you've done, to walk across the street, work in a major Washington law firm. I guess you don't have to file personal disclosure forms anymore, mm-hmm. so I don't know how much money you make, but it's not nothing. Mm-hmm. What about that system? How can that be reformed?
Well, some people think the congressional pension system and other government pensions are too high. That's being examined. But actually, the congressional pension is not by any means the most generous in Congress. Probably the most generous are federal judges who have their own salaries never diminished as long as they live. They go on an active status. And military pensions not contributed to. They don't require contribution. And when somebody serves 30 years in the military, they retired at two-thirds.
Well, is that defending something because they're doing it?
No, but I'm just saying that I think it has to be looked at in context. I'm now in the private sector, and I can tell you that private compensation and private pensions are very often much, much more generous than anything that's done at the government level. Whether it's something that's excessive or beyond what the country wants to do, I think is going to be examined. I think the present Congress is probably going to take a look at it.
You served in Congress through Watergate. You served in Congress mm-hmm. through the reform movements of the mid-70s, the Pike and Church Commission. After Watergate and all its reforms, we still have, in many people's eyes, scandalous campaign finance. After the Church and Pike committees, we still had Iran-Contra. Do things get better?
Well, I think they do get better. And for example, there was a book written not too long ago, 4 or 5 years ago, by Suzanne Garment entitled Scandal. And the thesis of this book is that the standards of public behavior and conduct are improving and have improved over the last 25 years. But the public reaction is that things are getting worse in Washington and people are misbehaving more and there's more scandal. That's simply not the case. And the people who live and work there, I think, know that's not the case. But every government, every institution is going to have need for review of its conduct and activities. Today, we're going through all kinds of review of the intelligence agencies by private and public groups, looking to a possible reorganization of their effort. But I still think intelligence is an important activity that needs to be carried on. The American government, I think, is probably, arguably, the most upright and the most... scandal-free of any, at least at the level of that I've experienced it, of any in the world. I would be hard-pressed to name one that's better.
And where does the public perception come from that government is evil, government is bad, government can't do anything? And presidents, of course, ever since Richard Nixon, have been running on this theme as being an outsider, as being the person who can reform government. Mm-hmm. I don't know how Bob Dole thinks he's going to pull that theme off if he tries it, but Bill Clinton certainly did.
Well, I think that's one part of the problem, frankly. Not only the people, like presidential candidates, but members of Congress themselves. I mean, I wouldn't exempt members of Congress from blame. Every once in a while, I used to hear members describe how they'd go to a public meeting and somebody would stand up and criticize the Congress, and they'd agree with them. They wouldn't disagree with them. They'd say, you're right, and so forth. But I'm different, of course. I'm not the kind of person you're describing. I was glad to see Bob Dole the other day stand up and say that he didn't join those who thought that government was terrible and couldn't do any good and was all bad and the rest of it.
How could he?
Well, he's been involved with it for a long time, that's right. But it's also obvious that we have to be sure that government doesn't overreach, that it doesn't tax too much, that it doesn't waste money, that it doesn't get involved in abuses of rights. Those things are a requirement in any society. And in ours, where we have the tools and the means to do that, we should exercise them constantly. On the other hand, it is also, to me, a kind of an irony that the American government, which has spread its influence throughout the world, where from Alexander Plots to the Soviet Union to the Tiananmen Square and South Africa, the spirit of democratic reform has been ignited by this country, basically by other democracies as well, but this country principally. And here at home, we've got more people doubting that the system works, more cynicism, more distrust, more anger at our own government that I think any kind of realistic examination of it would justify. When I went to Congress in 1965, 30 years ago, the average American, when asked how much of the time can you trust the government, said three-quarters of them answered most or all of the time. Last year, when that question was asked, less than 25%, less than one in four, said you could trust the government most or all of the time.
Let me just ask you one final question, Mr. Speaker. The perception in the United States that voting doesn't make a difference, that politicians don't make a difference. The low, as you mentioned, voter turnout, which is now lower than ever in the Republican primaries, we're talking 15, 17%, something like that, of people participating. How do you think that's going to be turned around by the present political system, the two-party system? Or are we going to have something more than a two-party system, perhaps a Perot party, a Ralph Nader party, something like that, in order to reinvigorate public participation?
Well, I hope we can find ways to do it, because I'm not sure what the answer is, frankly, in a simple prescription. But I'm not sure that third parties are the answer. For one thing, third or fourth parties tend to have a perverse effect in our politics. There's an old American song, you always hurt the one you love. A party that is more progressive and more liberal tends to hurt the Democratic side of the ticket. A party that's libertarian and extremely conservative or ideological on the right tends to hurt the Republican Party. So the problem with that kind of third or fourth party configuration is they always tend to help the party or the philosophy or the approach they least respect and support, not the one they most respect and support.
But we have examples in European democracies, for example, in France and in Italy, where there are, in Germany, where there are multi-party groupings that represent a broader spectrum than here, and those countries don't seem to be falling apart politically. In fact, they have much greater voter participation than we have here.
Well, that's true, but they have a greater voter participation sort of year in and year out in almost all countries. That's unfortunately one of our real weaknesses, that we don't turn out a great percentage of our registered or eligible voters. But political cultures are different. Japan is moving now, I think, much more toward a U.S.-style, almost two-party system, perhaps. And in those countries that have multiple parties, you often have to have coalitions, and coalitions sometimes can get you into the difficult problem of having the tail wagging the dog, where the critical small party may make demands on the major party coalition partner that really are against its interest and arguably the interest of the electorate. Anyway, it's a difficult. So the important thing is that democracy is still the best, or as Winston Churchill said, the worst of all systems except for every other. And it's, I think, for most Americans, still an ideal, and they need to involve themselves.
Thank you very much, former House Speaker Thomas Foley.
And thank you, Larry Bensky. Larry will be joining us from Texas tomorrow. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with Pat Greenfield. Our engineer is Kenneth Mason. Help today from Harriet Tansman and Errol Maitland. Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, it's Super Tuesday. We'll talk with Cecile Richards, daughter of former Texas Governor Ann Richards. Cecile has started a group called the Texas Freedom Network, which challenges the Christian Coalition. You can order cassette tapes of Democracy Now! By calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to Democracy Now!